Chapter 5. I slept, as is my custom, quite well that night, waking to a chilly, fog-bound morning and the weight of Vespertine draped over my legs and pinning me to the bed. I shoved him off and made my ablutions, reaching for a comfortable work ensemble of dark blue tweed piped narrowly in velvet. It reminded me a little of the princess's costume, although nothing near as fashionable. But the cut was serviceable and the colour flattering, and I made my way to the Belvedere with a brisk step. Stoker and I habitually took breakfast there, the food brought down from the main house by George, the hall boy, and laid out in a sort of buffet atop a Greco-Roman sarcophagus. I had just finished my repast when Stoker appeared, looking a little the worse for wear. He had not shaved, and the dark growth always in evidence after a day's passing was a heavy shadow. He wore his eye patch, a sure sign that his old injury, the one responsible for damaging his eye and leaving the narrow scar running from brow to jaw, was troubling him. I gave him an inquiring look. "How was your meteor shower?"
"Non-existent," he growled. "The bloody fog rolled in and we could not see 2 feet. Lady Rose was so mightily put out I had to teach her sea shanties until 2 in the morning to get her to go to bed like a nice child."
"Sea shanties?"
"I was rather hoping that a little forthright naval language might persuade Lord Rosemoran he should forbid her from associating with me,"
he said, his expression hopeful. "She will find a way," I warned him. His face fell, and he helped himself to a plate of eggs and sausages. He ate in silence for several minutes, then began to toss scraps to the dogs.
"Was it a jealous rival in mountaineering? A thwarted lover? A failed climbing student?"
I roused myself from my reverie. "I beg your pardon?"
"Alice Baker Green's murderer,"
he said.
"I presume you have spent the last few hours inventing theories."
"I do not invent theories," I retorted in my chilliest tone. "I look at the facts and make deductions. There is such a thing as proper scientific method, you know." He shrugged.
"I presumed you couldn't resist the urge to fling yourself headlong into another investigation, regardless of my objections."
I folded my arms over my chest. The fact that he had so neatly deduced my state of mind was maddening. "I do not fling myself anywhere. I have, upon occasion, been called upon to use my talents in the pursuit of justice. If I am called upon in the future, I shall, of course, do so again, but I have no need to go looking for such a thing." The fact that this statement was not entirely a truthful reflection of my intentions was not, I decided, relevant to the conversation.
"Good,"
he said flatly. I opened my mouth, but the expression upon his face stopped me. The resentment at being told what to do ebbed, and I almost reached for his hand. Instead, I sipped the last of my tea, taking a moment to meditate upon the conclusion of our last adventure and how easily it might have ended in tragedy. "We have been fortunate," I began.
"We have been damned lucky,"
he corrected, his expression somber.
"Veronica, either of us might have been killed through these ridiculous endeavours. I admit I ought not to have said anything about the rope. That was akin to running a hare in front of a hound. But we decided yesterday to leave this with the Chancellor to see what he decides. And the more I think on it, the more I believe we should, just this once, let things lie as they are. Alice Baker Green's grandmother is her only family, and she is satisfied. So should we be."
"How?" I demanded. "How can we let such an injustice pass without making at least an attempt to see it rectified?"
We did,
he reminded me.
We presented the evidence, scant as it was, to the princess. She promised to pass the matter along to the Chancellor.
And what if he is not inclined to pursue it?
Then it is at an end,
he said with a shrug. And you are content with that? My tone betrayed my astonishment.
Why does it surprise you?
He helped himself to another piece of toast, lavishing this one with honey. Because the Revelstoke Templeton Vane I have known flings himself headlong into adventure, I jibed. He does not shrink from a challenge. His gaze was level, and perhaps even slightly amused.
That is what you think I am doing, shrinking from a challenge?
I felt instantly the unfairness of the charge. Stoker, more than any person I had ever known, had shown himself not just willing to hurl himself into danger, but happy to do so. I could never consider without a shudder the glint of unholy excitement I had detected in his gaze when he prepared to do battle with an enormous combatant armed only with a rebenke, a narrow leather whip that might have flayed the flesh from his bones. Coupled with that, the numerous near drownings, stabbings, shootings, and broken bones he had acquired in my company, I had done him a gross disservice in needling him on such a point. Perhaps not, I conceded, muttering the words into a sausage.
Let us finish the exhibition to the best of our ability,
he suggested.
That will honour Alice Baker Green's memory and improve the cause of mountaineering, especially for women. Surely that is a worthy tribute to her.
Indeed, I said, my expression brightening. And then we will devote ourselves anew to the work here. My case of Ornithoptera priamus Poseidon chrysalides are very nearly ready to emerge. This was no fabrication. I had been sent a case of the rare creatures as a Christmas present from Stoker's elder brother, Lord Templeton Vane. Tiberius, to his friends. His lordship had embarked upon a series of travels with an eye to mending his grieving heart, and I had taken the opportunity to suggest a few stops of arresting natural beauty that might contribute to restoring his peace of mind. The fact that the locations were all host to the most elusive and coveted specimens of Lepidoptera was the merest coincidence. The first parcel from Tiberius included a collection of O.P. Poseidon, common green birdwings, with a considerable supply of their favourite host plant, the Indian birthwort, or Dutchman's pipe.
Interesting how Tiberius's travels are taking him to the most fertile hunting grounds for butterflies,
Stoker observed mildly.
The merest happenstance, I presume.
His mouth twitched, and I knew he was close to laughing. I might have sent him a letter or two with suggestions on beauty spots he would appreciate, I allowed, but I suspect you know that, as you no doubt sent him a few hints of your own. He coloured slightly.
There is a pretty little sloth I have been coveting,
he admitted.
If he happened to find one, I should not be entirely displeased.
I shall tell him to make you a birthday present of one, I promised. With that rare sympathy we shared, he fell silent then, holding my gaze, and I knew what he wanted. I sighed. I give you my word that I will not seek out any further involvement in the matter of Alice Baker Green's death.
Then why,
he asked gravely,
do I suspect you of crossing your fingers?
Before I could form an indignant response, young George appeared, waving a note overhead. Delivered by messenger, he said, in breathless excitement as he thrust it into my hands. My name and Stoker's were scrawled on the envelope. The missive inside contained only a few hasty words. Come at once. Curiosity Club. C. I snatched up my hat and cloak and urged Stoker to haste. Something is amiss, I told him, as he thrust his arms into his greatcoat, the tails flapping behind him as we strode along Marylebone Street. Lady C has the tidiest penmanship I have ever seen, but this looks as if it were written by an inebriated moose. I stood on tiptoe on the edge of the pavement, straining to see an empty cab. Stoker cupped his hands to his mouth and made a sound of such eldritch horror that half the horses in the street started in surprise. But a cab came trotting smartly around the corner, and we sprang inside, urging the driver to make haste. Still, the streets were thick with traffic, wagons and carriages and carts all jostling for place with the monstrous bulk of omnibuses, while pedestrians picked their way as best they could through the throng. There were a few hours of short, sharp daylight that time of year, and the city never seemed more alive to me than in the brief, bright hours in which so much business was conducted. Amidst the odours of horse and burning coal, I could smell roasting chestnuts and the occasional whiff of wood smoke. The air was damp and heavy, the clouds gathering to draw a grey veil over the sun.
The weather is turning,
Stoker remarked, as he cast a practised eye upon the line of rooftops.
It will be icy by morning.
I shivered in my seat. Like all butterfly hunters, I was most at home in tropical lands, where the most flamboyant species of Lepidoptera flourished. Give me a jungle, a forest lush with green and thick with flower-scented air that steamed gently, pulsing with life and promise, and I was a happy woman. This sooty, smirched chill that penetrated one's clothes and settled into the bones was most difficult to bear in January. The calendar had turned, the days were lengthening, spring was a promise, but it was a long and shiversome season until May blossoms would ripen. It took longer than I might have preferred to reach the club, but we arrived at last to find Lady C's anxious white face peering from one of the upstairs windows. She dropped the curtain when she saw us alight from the hansom, hurrying downstairs to meet us as we entered.
Whatever is the problem?
Stoker began, but she hissed him to silence. Hush, not here, upstairs, she said, bustling us up to the exhibition room. She drew a key from her pocket and unlocked the door, making it fast behind us once she had peered down the corridors to make certain we were not observed. Stoker did not have to repeat his question. There was a gentle crunch underfoot as we trod on broken glass, powdering it into the carpet. The display cabinet had been broken. An unfortunate accident, I began, but Lady C shook her head. There are scratches on the lock, she told us, her expression grim. Someone had a go at forcing it but couldn't manage it. They might have feared to take too long or simply lacked the strength to break it. In any event, they found it easier to break the glass.
What is missing?
Stoker asked, peering in the cabinet. Only one thing, as far as I know, she said. Alice Baker Green's summit badge from the Alpenwalder Climbing Society. Stoker and I surveyed the contents of the case. Everything I had placed there was accounted for, albeit several things had been jostled in the miscreant's theft, and bits of glass sparkled like diamonds on the velvet display cloth.
Have you looked through the rest of the exhibition?
Stoker asked. Lady C shook her head. That is why I asked you to come. I thought you might notice more than I would if anything else had been taken. We made a quick appraisal of the various shelves and cabinets, looked through the photographs and mementos. Stoker quietly moved behind the draperies where we had stowed the parcel with the climbing rope as I turned to Lady C. Nothing else appears to be missing. Her shoulders relaxed.
Well, that is a mercy,
although how I am to explain to Mrs. Baker Green that her granddaughter's summit badge is missing is anyone's guess. I am not looking forward to telling her we have managed to lose one of her most treasured mementos. You hardly lost it, I pointed out. It was stolen. Because we were lax with security, she returned in some bitterness. Perhaps we ought to engage some sort of security, although we have never had need of it before. There has always been an atmosphere of trust in this place, a trust that has now been grossly violated.
Who was here yesterday evening? I asked.
She spread her hands. The members come and go, as you well know. The ledger is supposed to be used to sign in whenever one visits, but that is not always practiced, she added, with a slightly reproachful glance at me. It was not undeserving. I myself occasionally failed to sign the ledger, and had even earned a stern rebuke from the club authorities for omitting to declare Stoker as a guest one evening. The club had strict rules about the admission of gentlemen, permitting them only by prior arrangement or during events which were open to the public. Lady C went on, furrowing her brow. I suppose I ought to go and inspect the ledger and see what I can learn from that. I cannot imagine any member of the club doing such a thing, I began.
They didn't, Stoker said soberly as he came to join us.
Lady C brightened. What makes you say that?
Because it is not just the badge that has vanished, he said, giving me a level look. The cut climbing rope is missing. Veronica and I put it behind the draperies for safekeeping, and it is gone.
Lady C stared at him a long moment. I do not understand. The badge, at least, was metal. Why on earth would someone wish to take an old rope?
Because it was very likely a murder weapon, I told her.
She took a deep, shuddering breath. I must go to Hestia, she said, invoking the name of the portress and directress of the club. She has been deciding upon a course of action and wishes to meet at once.
We will clear it up, I told her. I know where the brooms are.
She hurried off, and I bent to tidying away the broken glass. No easy task when much of it had been ground to slivers in the carpet.
You can leave off smiling any time, you know,
Stoker said, as he plucked splinters of glass from the velvet display shelves. I am not smiling.
Veronica, I can see your face. I know precisely what your mouth is doing.
I sat back on my haunches. Very well, I am smiling. Do you know why?
Because you think this will change something,
he said, calmly dropping the splinters into a dustpan. It changes everything. We know now that our hypothesis was correct. Alice Baker Green was murdered.
That is not our hypothesis,
he pointed out.
It is yours, and it demonstrates a woeful failure of logic.
I made a scoffing noise. You were the one who first introduced the possibility of murder, I reminded him.
For which I am immensely sorrowful, he replied. One cut rope does not a murder make.
It does if that cut rope meant a woman plunged to her death. Ow! I swore as a bit of glass jammed into my finger.
Let me see, he ordered. Here in the light.
I went to stand next to him, extending my finger where a bright bead of ruddy blood stood. He peered at it, then took a slender knife from his pocket. Stoker's pockets were invariably a repository for all manner of oddments. Coins, vestas, paper twists of sweets, great crimson handkerchiefs, assorted glass eyeballs, lockpicks. One never knew what lurked in there, but Stoker always managed to produce the proper tool for any occasion. He bent his head to the task, plying the knife point so quickly and deftly that I never felt the splinter move. He dropped it into the dustpan with a delicate clink, and the blood welled afresh. I expected him to wrap it in one of his enormous scarlet handkerchiefs. Instead, he took the fingertip in his mouth, giving it a gentle suck. A jolt of a most arresting sensation coursed through me, so much so that I was entirely incapable of speech. After a moment, he removed my finger from his lips, examining it in satisfaction.
"The suction and the saliva help with clotting," he told me. "Of course, it is not a technique one would care to employ on anyone to whom one was not intimately connected."
I said nothing. I stepped closer, lifting my face to his as I applied a caress to a specific and wholly enthralling portion of his anatomy to assess its readiness.
"Veronica!"
He grasped my wrists, putting me firmly away.
"This is hardly the time or place,"
he began. I moved forward again, pressing my hips to his. "That is rather the point," I murmured.
"We will be discovered,"
he protested. "Will we?" I breathed, trailing a kiss from his earlobe down his neck. "How very dangerous."
"Veronica."
This time it was a groan, and he did not push me aside. Instead, he buried his hands in my hair, kissing me as thoroughly as he did everything, which is to say, expertly and with exquisite attention to detail. I was just reaching for the hem of my petticoat when he gave a maidenly gasp and thrust me away.
"Veronica, what has got into you? That is quite enough,"
he said, straightening his disordered garments. He buttoned his shirt, finishing just as Lady C appeared. I dropped the last splinter of glass into the dustpan.
"Hestia has spoken with the Alpenwalders. It has been decided the less said about this the better," she told us, her expression grim.
"The Alpenwalders? What business is it of theirs?" I demanded. Lady C's tone was even, but it seemed an effort.
"They are underwriting the expenses of the exhibition, and Hestia felt obliged to inform them of this development. They were most insistent upon discretion. They have a horror of any sort of bad publicity."
"Reasonable enough," Stoker put in. "If the mountaineering business is already suffering thanks to Alice Baker Green's death, then any news story which revives the whole sordid business must be unwelcome."
"Exactly that," Lady C said. "And Hestia agrees with them. She will have a joiner come tomorrow to fit a new panel of glass to the cabinet. In the meanwhile, the room is to be kept locked at all times, and I will keep the key."
"What of the thefts?" Stoker inquired.
"At Hestia's encouragement, I will, of course, write to Mrs. Baker Green to inform her of the loss of the summit badge," she said evasively.
"And the rope?" I challenged. She smoothed her skirts.
"There is no need to mention it further." "You cannot possibly mean to condone theft," I began. "I am not condoning anything, because I do not know who has perpetrated this deed, and it will profit no one to pursue it," she pointed out in a too reasonable voice. "It is out of my hands, Veronica, and the decision has been made. The matter goes no further."
She looked around.
"Very tidy," she said, giving an approving nod. "Your hard work is much appreciated. Now, if you do not mind, I have to leave, and I am under orders to permit no one to remain without either myself or Hestia in attendance. You do not trust us alone in the exhibit we are helping to mount? I asked, my voice dangerously calm. It is not a matter of trust, she said, moving towards the door. It is a matter of knowing when to let things be for the greater good. She escorted us from the room and locked it firmly behind us, pocketing the key. Thank you for your assistance today. You have been most helpful. Not as helpful as we might, I protested, sotto voce. It occurred to me to storm Hestia in her eyrie and demand she take the matter seriously, but I did no such thing. To begin with, I had Stoker in tow, and gentlemen were not received in the offices except by prior appointment, and, if I am to be honest, I was distracted and unhappy at the turn of events. I am rather put out with Lady C, I quibbled, as Stoker and I journeyed back to Bishop's Folly. I thought she had more spirit than to simply accept a directive from on high. She seems to forget that we are highly experienced in these matters and brushes us aside as if we were kitchen maids. Come to think of it, she might as well have summoned maids to tidy up that mess, and I wonder she did not.
She needed people she could trust, he pointed out as he stared at the passing scenery.
She did not trust us, I reminded him. She set us to clearing up and then ordered us out.
She trusted us with the truth of the burglary.
Until she decided to take orders from Hestia and sweep the whole matter under the carpet, I said darkly. It was the first time Lady C and I had even approached a falling out. We had travelled together the previous year, and she had shared confidences with me that I knew she had enjoyed with no other soul on earth. It rankled, then, that she would not trust me now with something so much less personal. I thought we were friends, I muttered, when Stoker did not reply. He continued to stare out the window, distracted. I poked experimentally at his ribs, and he jumped a mile.
What in the name of seven hells was that for?
He asked, rubbing at his torso. I was abusing Lady C. Your response to that ought to be one of undiluted support for my position.
I was friends with Lady C before you and I were ever acquainted, he reminded me. And I happen to think she is right in this case. The Alpenwalders are a notoriously touchy lot. It would no doubt sour relations between our countries to pursue this incident.
It is not an incident, I corrected sharply. A woman has been murdered, and I am apparently the only person who cares. He sighed.
We have no proof.
Because it was stolen. He gave a growl of frustration and reached for me, but I slid to the far end of the seat. Do not put a hand on me, or I will demonstrate for you the Corsican stranglehold taught me by a very nice bandit chief of my acquaintance. He gave me a wary look as if he doubted my purpose, but he remained where he was, clearly reluctant to risk my willingness to inflict bodily harm.
You seemed eager enough for me to put a hand on you at the club, he said mildly.
That was different. My cheeks were hot, beating with blood. That was when I thought you cared about innocent victims and righting injustices.
Or,
he said slowly,
was it when there was a possibility we might be discovered and you found yourself excited by the danger of it?
I said nothing, keeping my gaze pinned to the seat opposite. He gave a little laugh and settled back in the seat. His hand crept near mine and I slapped it away. He laughed again, and when the cab drew to a stop outside the little side gate at Bishop's Folly, I sprang from my seat, leaving him to pay. By the time he had sorted out the fare and bade the driver farewell, I was halfway to my vivarium. I did not look back. Chapter 6. For the remainder of the day, I busied myself in the vivarium in contemplation of my chrysalides. The butterflies were proving decidedly reluctant to emerge, but I attended the Indian birthwort faithfully, watering it and pruning the odd dead leaf to ensure a proper food supply when they chose to make their appearance. When I had finished, I moved on to a special corner where I was nurturing the last of my malachites. I had secured a very small population of Cyproetta stellanese caterpillars from the Iguazu Falls of the Argentine and had guarded them fiercely through their pupation. They had rewarded my care with a brilliant display of colour and size, the largest growing to an astonishing 4¾ inches, well beyond the average for that particular lepidopteran. They were, as their common name suggests, a pretty shade of green, albeit without the emerald flamboyance of the Rajah Brooks birdwing, one of my personal favourites. But the viridian of my malachites was enchanting in its own right, and I watched them with tremendous satisfaction as they flapped and fluttered their way around the vivarium. Like most other butterflies, they suckled nectar from flowers, but their favourite food was rotting fruit, lavishly supplemented with bat dung and the occasional mammalian corpse. His lordship's coachman provided a steady supply of mice from the carriage house, which my greedy malachites devoured with gusto. It was a curious thing to observe butterflies feeding eagerly on dead flesh, a sight that caused more than one lady visitor to recoil and reach for her smelling salts. I never begrudged them their curious diet. They offered too much joy in return to quibble over a few bloated mice here and there. It was in the nature of butterflies to live transitory lives, fleeting as they were lovely, and it was with resignation that I watched as they lived out their brief existence, bursting into jeweled magnificence and then, after a few short months of activity, fading into oblivion. It was no easy feat to keep them alive throughout the deepening chill of a British autumn. The coal fires were kept stoked, and the steam heat pushed through the pipes of the vivarium with the warmth of Hades. But still, it was a struggle to drive the temperature above 80 degrees Fahrenheit, the necessary threshold for malachites to fly. They drooped lower and lower upon their leaves, sulking amidst the bushes until, one by one, they perished, fluttering gracefully to the stone floor like drifts of paper borne on an ill wind. I had collected them as they died, removing them gently to the belvedere, where I mounted each upon a piece of card, penned with the name of the species and its place of origin and date and place of death. There was one last holdout against the intemperate frosts, the largest and most theatrical of the males, an enormous fellow who winged slowly about the females, dazzling them with his size rather than his speed. The smaller males darted furiously about, displaying their wings in lavishly acrobatic manoeuvres, but my big, slow, steady favourite, whom I nicknamed Hercules, outdid them all, securing the favours of even the most timid of maiden butterflies. The vast majority of the dainty green eggs that had been laid amidst the shrubs were the product of his bridal flights, and in the end he was the only one left, moving like a sad shadow through the limbs of the little jungle I had created, as if searching for the friends and wives he had lost. I was not entirely surprised to find that his time had come at last. He lay on the floor of the vivarium in the shadow of a bush, his wings still trembling with the effort of flight. I lifted him onto my palm, bringing my hand up to my face so that I might see him clearly. He raised one forewing in what a fanciful person might have called a salute. "Goodbye, my dear little friend," I murmured. "Rest now." He flapped again a time or two, but remained nestled in my palm. I sat in the fragrant, steamy air of the vivarium, perspiration pearling my temples, and marvelled at this exquisite creature with his viridian wings, so delicate they seemed hardly capable of holding his weight aloft. And yet they had, bearing him throughout his adventures until at long last his voyaging was finished. They were miracles of architecture, the Lepidoptera, and I felt, along with a pang of loss, a fervent gratitude that I had discovered them as my life's work. There was nothing so fragile as a butterfly wing, nor anything as lovely. When at last he lay still, I rose to my feet and carried him out of the shocking warmth of the only home he had known, through the bone-snapping cold of the gardens and into the Belvedere. I worked for some time, pinning him gently whilst his wings were still pliable and unlikely to break. I wrote a description of this most extraordinary avatar of Cyproetta Stellanes. After a moment's consideration, I took up my pen again. Known to his friends as Hercules. It was a curious thing to write an epitaph for a butterfly, but it seemed wrong not to honour the dead when we have known them, no matter how small. As wrong as leaving Alice Baker Green's murderer unpunished, I thought in some agitation. Dropping the matter was not a choice I made with any great enthusiasm, and I knew it was one Stoker and I would revisit at another time. But I stood a better chance of persuading him if I could marshal a little proof, some tiny indication that a villain had been at work, snatching the life of an innocent woman before her time. And somehow, I promised myself, I would find it. Whilst I brooded, Stoker was busily engaged in wrestling with his walrus, an occupation that kept him occupied through the dinner hour. In the end, I ordered a tray from the kitchen, choosing to take my meal in solitude, opening the last post of the day as I ate in my little chapel. Cook had sent a fine breast of duck with a potato and apple galette, but the food gave scant satisfaction when I read my letters. There was one from Lady Wellingtonia Beauclerc, the Earl's elderly aunt and my unexpected friend. Born on the eve of Waterloo, she had served as the power behind the throne for decades, clearing up the untidy messes of the royal family and protecting them from their worst impulses to self-destruction. Given her loyalty to them, she might well have destroyed me for the danger I presented with my secret and semi-legitimate status. Instead, she had befriended me as she had Stoker, offering wisdom and an unsentimental affection that meant more to me than most attachments I had ever known. Her usually robust health had taken a turn for the worse during the Ripper's reign of terror, and after much reflection on her own mishandling of the affair, she had taken herself off to Scotland to her shooting box to recuperate. Given the inclement nature of Scottish weather, I rather suspected she had gone to sulk instead, and she had missed the Yuletide, usually spent in the bosom of her rumbustious family. I surveyed the scrawled note as I picked at my duck. She had scribbled a few lines, indicating that she was recovering her health, albeit more slowly than either of us would have wished. I missed her dreadfully, and I was not entirely comfortable with that emotion. Between her departure and that of Tiberius, I felt abandoned by my friends, a state of affairs I would not have credited only a year before. I was accustomed to living my life as unfettered as one of my beloved butterflies, and these new bonds of attachment brought with them not only connection and warmth, but a dreadful sensation of loss when my companions were not present. I shoved her letter aside and picked up another, this written on heavy paper embellished with the heading of the Sudbury Hotel. It was short and equally unsatisfying. My dear Miss Speedwell, I hope this note finds you well. I am writing to inform you that His Excellency, Chancellor von Reckstein, declines to address the matter you brought to our attention. With kind regards, Baroness Margarita von Wallenberg. I shook the envelope, but there was nothing more. Only a single line of dismissal to indicate that nothing would be done to investigate the murder of Alice Baker Green. My chance to persuade Stoker to undertake this new adventure was at an end, and I was, quite plainly, bereft. But why? I had not known the woman well, I reminded myself, and countless miscarriages of justice were done every day. Why did this particular lack of conclusion feel so brutal? I put this letter aside, shoving away the plate of duck. It was congealing now, and I had no appetite for it. I was conscious only of a keen, sharp-edged sense of loss. I had, by any measure, all that I could wish for. I was healthy and not uncomely. I had work I loved, friends I treasured, and a man for whom I would walk through fire, and, in fact, had upon occasion and in the most literal sense. I could find no reason for the overwhelming sense of agitation I felt, but I rebelled against it. I had experienced such emotions once or twice before. The remedy, I had found, was movement. To hurl one's few possessions into a carpet bag and embark for a new adventure was the only solace. To leave behind one's woes in a damp and fog-bound land, awaking in brilliant sunshine, the air heavy with spices and the promise of fresh endeavours, this was true happiness. A train bound for anywhere, a ship unfurling its sails for some new shore. Steam whistle and snapping canvas, those were the lullabies that soothed a savage soul. And I had no recourse to them, I reflected bitterly. For now that I had joined myself in affection to Stoker, I could no longer run from myself as I had once so blithely done. I must, instead, sit and face my demons. For a long while, too long, I sat sulking in the gloom as the candles guttered out and the fire burned low. Unlike the Roman baths and the vivarium with their lavish steam heat, the Follies had not been fitted with modern conveniences. It was left to me to tend my own modest hearth. After the clock had struck 10, I noticed a growing chill, something more insistent than the usual January cold. I opened the door of the Folly, gazing up at the moon. It was waxing, very nearly full, a lopsided baroque pearl of a moon. But it was shrouded in grey shadows, rimmed with cold blue light, and I saw splinters of ice dancing in the glow of the doorway. I shut the door quickly against the brutal cold, stirring up the fire until it crackled merrily. I whistled to Vespertine, curling myself against his wiry, woolly warmth as I watched the flames. I could pretend to myself for just a little while that they were not plain London flames, kindled on a hearth of simple stone. They were the flames of a bonfire scented with herbs on a Corsican hillside, of a funeral pyre lavish with incense on a riverbank in India, of a cook fire in South America, smelling of roasting meats. I smiled to myself, thinking of my adventures, and in due course, warmed by my memories and my dog, I slept. I woke to bitter cold, the windows rimed with a narrow tracery of ice. I washed, gritting my teeth against the frigid water, and dressed in my warmest ensemble, a costume of heavy violet wool tweed with lapels of black velvet. I had had a little coat made of black velvet for Vespertine, but he gave me a reproachful look from under his heavy brows as I tried to fit it, preferring instead to bound out into the frosted gardens as soon as I opened the door. Bettany, whose thick coat was meant for the wind-ravished steppes of the Caucasus, was romping happily in the brittle, frost-blackened grass, whilst Huxley and Newt were nowhere to be seen. I found them, curled one on either side of Stoker as he finished his breakfast, his attention fixed upon the newspaper propped against the teapot. I hastened upstairs to examine once more the file of cuttings on Alice Baker Green. There was no new information to be found. I had read every piece thoroughly the day before. I tossed them aside in exasperation. A single new snippet of information would be enough, I told myself. Just one small wisp to dangle in front of Stoker to coax him into action. I had no notion of what I required, only that there must be something to intrigue him, goading him to undertake the investigation of his own volition. It took me less than a quarter of an hour to find it, an issue of the Daily Harbinger from the end of November. The Ripper news had settled into something less than hysteria, and one or two measured voices suggested his reign of terror might have come to an end. Without fresh victims to exploit, the Harbinger had been forced to revive other stories, raking them afresh to blaze back into the white-hot heat of scandal. And they had done their best with the meagre details of Alice Baker Green's death, revisiting the story of her fatal fall, this time with eyewitness accounts in lurid detail and assorted photographs. One picture I had seen before, the posed portrait of Alice on the Alpenwald, but it was bracketed with an earlier photograph of her standing atop a peak in the United States, suffragette banner in hand. The last was a particularly unappetizing funeral portrait of Alice lying in her coffin after her funeral. My eyes flicked swiftly from the photograph to the byline, and I found no surprises there. J.J. Butterworth from Hochstadt, the Alpenwald. Our old friend had taken herself off to the tiny principality to interview witnesses, no doubt embellishing their stories with a few enhancements of her own invention. She had included a summary of the coroner's report, verdict, accidental death, as well as the formal testimony of Captain Durand, the commander of the princess's personal guard and a frequent climber himself. He testified to witnessing Alice climb that day, explaining that it was a common pastime of the Alpenwalders to observe the tiny black dots of mountaineers through telescopes fixed to the castle balconies. He explained that her climb had begun much in the usual way, and that he had watched her until she rounded the breast of the mountain, heading upwards to the unseen challenge of the Devil's Staircase. Some minutes later, he revealed, he had heard a scream, and then she had hurtled into view, falling from a terrible height to her instant death. Naturally, he rushed to the scene, as did many others who had witnessed her fall. The most usual route up the mountain, as sketched by the intrepid Miss Butterworth, began in a little wood just beyond the central square of Hochstadt, lying in a verdant green forest that nestled against the walls of the castle courtyard. To sit in one of the many beer gardens with a warm glass of spiced wine or a cold stein of beer and watch the climbers toil up the mountain was one of the Alpenwalders' favourite pastimes, it appeared, and dozens of people had watched Alice Baker Green fall to her death. There was nothing unusual in the circumstances, Captain Durand had insisted. A tragic accident, and no more. It was not until I read through JJ's interviews with Alice's landlady, the local priest, and the cheesemonger that I spotted it. The cheesemonger had seen Alice Baker Green that morning. It was her custom to carry a small cheese and a loaf in her knapsack when she climbed. She often departed shortly after dawn, preferring to watch the sun rise on the slope of the mountain and take her breakfast on the Devil's Staircase as she rested and sketched the routes. That morning, she had been in high spirits, he said, planning to test a new variation on the Devil's Staircase that might prove useful when the snows set in before her winter climb. He had waved her off and watched her begin her climb. One other climber appeared that morning, a slender, mustachioed man who began to climb a little while before Alice, but whose appearance was nothing near as thrilling as a sighting of the famous mountaineer. JJ slipped into sticky sentimentality when she concluded that the climber might well have been the last person to see Alice alive on the mountain, and ended the piece with a plea to the young man to come forward so she might tell his version of events to the public. She dangled the promise of a reward, but though I scoured the later numbers of the newspaper, I could find no further mention of Alice Baker Green. No doubt JJ's publisher refused to sanction any further continental adventures and had ordered her home before she could track down the elusive young man. I suppressed a sigh. This was precious little bait to use to entice Stoker into an investigation, I reflected darkly, as I tucked the newspaper under my arm. But I would make a manful attempt nonetheless. I went downstairs to the sarcophagus we used as a buffet, Greco-Roman and scarcely worth the cartonnage, and peeked under the lidded dishes dispatched from the main house's kitchens. Cook had outdone herself. In addition to the usual eggs and bacon, she had sent down a heaping portion of kedgeree and a plate of deviled kidneys. "How bad is the storm?" I asked Stoker as I filled my plate.
"Snow in Kent,"
he told me in a tone of bemusement.
"And west of the Tamar into the north of Cornwall, if you can believe it. It has snowed so heavily in the Midlands that the trains have stopped and nothing moves. Wales is completely cut off. What is the world coming to?"
"What of Scotland?" I asked in some concern. I worried for Lady Welly, marooned as she was in her Highland eyrie. Stoker intuited my thoughts, but his expression was unconcerned.
"She took Baring Ponsonby with her. I dare say she will be warm enough."
His mouth twitched with a suppressed smile as he spoke. Cecil Baring Ponsonby was a gentleman of even more advanced years than Lady Welly, but they had been lovers for decades. "Poor old Cecil is nearly 90, I reminded him. "He has no more business in such a climate than she does. They ought to have gone to Egypt, or a nice remote island in the South Pacific. His lordship owns property all over the world. Surely he might have made her the loan of a handy archipelago." Stoker snorted but said nothing, and I returned to the copy of the Daily Harbinger, scouring JJ's piece again. I focused this time on the photographs, feeling a sudden spear thrust of irritation that so robust and engaging a woman should have had her life cut short so brutally, so tragically. I peered at the funeral photograph, putting down my toast and reaching slowly for my magnifying glass. After a long moment, I sat back, smiling.
"I can hear you thinking, Veronica,"
Stoker said from behind his newspaper.
"What is it?"
Wordlessly, I produced the cutting and handed it over, using the magnifying glass to point out the detail in the photograph that had captured my attention. After a long moment, Stoker slumped in his chair.
"Bloody bollocking hell,"
he managed. I smiled, a purely feline expression of contentment, and he immediately bristled.
"See here, Veronica."
I held up a hand to forestall his objections. "No, let us have it plainly with no wrangling. Alice Baker Green was laid to her eternal rest wearing a climbing costume and the enameled badge of the Alpenwalder Kletterverein Gipfel Absichten."
"Your German pronunciation is execrable,"
he put in. "Do not sulk. It is unbecoming in a man of your age. I replied calmly. Now, this badge is not the plain badge worn by every mountaineer who climbs on the Teufelstrepper. It is the particular and very special badge awarded to those who achieve the summit. So, Miss Baker Green is buried in her mountaineering garb with an accolade from the society, a very special society, marking her accomplishment. Why, then, I am forced to ask, did we find that exact badge amongst her personal possessions at the club? And furthermore, why was Alice Baker Green's climbing badge stolen from the exhibition on the night before last? Stoker's response was pointed.
You cannot possibly know the answers to those questions.
I am a scientist, I told him ruthlessly. I do not require perfect knowledge in order to form a working hypothesis, only possibilities. Alice Baker Green was buried with an Alpenwalder summit badge. This we know from the photograph, I said, jabbing a finger towards the newspaper in his hand. Yet an identical, or nearly identical, badge was sent with her personal possessions from Hochstadt. Since an item cannot occupy two places at once, we may safely deduce that there are two badges. I paused, and he gave a grudging nod.
I suppose so.
Now, the badge we saw at the Curiosity Club was packed with Alice's personal possessions from her lodgings and conveyed directly here. It is, I happen to know, Alice's own badge.
How can you know that?
He demanded. I described the nick at the edge of the medal. Alice showed me herself. She said it got bashed about when she wore it climbing once and she intended never to wear it climbing again. I paused again and he made a restless gesture.
Get on with it,
he growled. The badge at the club is undoubtedly Alice's own, I repeated. But the badge she was buried with was not pinned to her clothing because it was not hers. Stoker waved the newspaper at me.
It is most definitely pinned to her clothing in this photograph.
But that is not where it was found, I pointed out. Read the article carefully, and you will be struck by one curious fact. The badge was found with her lifeless body on the Teufelstrepper, but clutched in her hand. This is the badge, the undamaged badge, that was pinned to her garments as she lay in her coffin, and I propose that this badge belonged to her murderer. I finished triumphantly, and was wrenched from his shirt as Alice Baker Green reached out for the last time whilst she struggled for her life on that mountain. He gave a deep groan.
Veronica, of all the melodramatic codswallop.
It is not codswallop. What is more logical than that Alice, whose rope was clearly cut in an act of sabotage, might have struggled with her attacker and ripped a badge from his clothing, carrying down the mountain a clue to his identity? Furthermore, you thought the same yourself, otherwise you would not have had so strenuous a reaction to the realization. Bloody bollocking hell were your words, I believe.
I admit I may have thought something along those lines at first, but almost at once I saw that there might be a dozen other perfectly logical explanations for the presence of a second badge amongst her things.
I would settle for one, I told him sweetly.
It might be a memento,
he said, shoving the newspaper back at me.
Surely she had a love affair or a friendship of some sort, one she mightn't have wanted made public, so the badge was a sentimental keepsake.
Possible but weak, I told him. 2 marks out of 10.
That suggestion is at least a 7,
he countered. I flapped a hand. 2, and I am being generous. First, she did have a possible relationship in the Alpenwald with a minor member of the royal family, Duke Maximilian of Lokendorf. Stoker's crow of triumph broke into my narrative. Naturally, I ignored him and carried on, raising my voice only slightly. "Say what you like, but it fits the facts," I protested. "The badge discovered in Alice's hand was that of her murderer, and I know who he was." Stoker blinked in astonishment.
"The devil you do."
I gave a little sigh of pleasure. "The mustachioed man." I nodded towards the newspaper. "Read on." Miss Butterworth was most thorough, but even she failed to deduce the likeliest explanation, that the mysterious man on the mountain was there for one purpose that morning. Murder.
"More likely her editors were afraid of drawing a costly lawsuit," Stoker replied.
Stoker read through the piece, his brows drawing further and lower with every line. When he had finished, he prowled through the rest of the cuttings, laying them side by side in a sort of timeline as he came to the end of each.
"All right. Let us suppose, for just a moment, that what you have said is possible, that Alice was murdered, and that the summit badge was stolen because it provides a clue. That gets us no closer to discovering who this person might have been."
"Of course it does." I enumerated the points on my fingers. "First, someone else's badge in Alice's dead hand means that the murderer must have been a climber, a proposition that is further confirmed by the presence of the mustachioed man on the mountain that day, our possible murderer. Second, only an experienced climber would have known how to tamper with the ropes at just the correct spot to ensure she fell to her death. Third, why else steal the rope and badge from the club if not to conceal the fact that it was murder and that the killer was a mountaineer? Altogether, this means that our villain must have been someone who not only climbs, but knew of the existence of the badge and rope in Alice's effects. In short, my dear Stoker, it was an Alpenwalder."
"Not necessarily,"
he said slowly. "You are determined to be difficult."
"It is a poor scientist who is so attached to her theory that she cannot entertain criticism of it,"
he countered. "Very well, go on."
"If it were an alpinist who killed her, and I do concede that only a skilled climber could have ascended to the Devil's Staircase in order to dispatch her, then yes, the badge and rope might offer clues as to the murderer's identity. But it does not necessarily follow that the murderer was an Alpenwalder."
"The description fits Duke Maximilian," I protested.
"The description of a man of mystery and moustaches also fits Douglas Norton."
"Perhaps," I admitted. He gave a snort and produced the cutting with Norton's photograph.
"Moustaches and slender."
I pulled a face.
"Don't pout, Veronica. It does not suit a woman of your age."
He grinned. I thought a moment, then gave him a triumphant look. "Douglas Norton could not have known the badge and rope would be in the effects sent to the club. Only someone in the Alpenwald would have known that." He rolled his eyes.
"The exhibition is a celebration of Alice Baker Green's lifetime as an alpinist. It is a reasonable expectation it would include artifacts from her last climb."
"Possibly." He grinned again.
"So, we are in agreement insofar as we believe it is possible that Alice was the victim of a calculated and deliberate murder carried out by a man with moustaches and climbing experience."
"Correct."
"But how does that fit with the theft of the items from the club?"
he asked, stroking his chin thoughtfully. He had shaved, imperfectly as usual, and there was a blue-black shadow at his jaw. With his long, tumbled ebony locks and the glint of gold hoops in his ears, He bore a striking resemblance to an Elizabethan buccaneer, even more so when he donned the eye patch he occasionally wore to rest the eye that had been injured in a dispute with a jaguar. Stoker, I should mention, emerged wounded and scarred from the fight, but very much alive, which is more than one can say for the jaguar. In any event, surveying his physical charms was a distraction I could not afford, I told myself sternly. I had a murderer to catch. I clipped the last article I had unearthed and placed it with the other cuttings, bundling them neatly into a file while Stoker continued to muse.
It might have been anyone,
he said finally. How can you possibly think so? I demanded. The only people in the room were the Alpenwalder delegation of the princess and her lady-in-waiting, Lady C, and the pair of us. In case it has escaped your notice, none of us is a mustachioed man of superlative climbing ability.
No, but we were not the only ones to see those particular items,
he pointed out.
Someone recovered Alice's things. Someone packed and shipped them.
Surely if the murderer was involved in conveying her things, they would have removed them, I protested.
Perhaps they could not,
he theorized.
Perhaps they were never alone with her possessions. They might have bided their time until now, when they were relatively easy to retrieve from the club.
It would take an audacious murderer to do such a thing, I said slowly.
More audacious than attacking a world-class climber on a mountain? If this is indeed how she was murdered, then the killer is a man of tremendous nerve and excellent timing, both skills that a mountaineer must possess, in any event. And if it was, he went on, there is always the possibility that the killer never intended to retrieve the rope and badge at all. Think of it. If some of Alice's things go missing, it draws attention to them. But a bit of rope and a badge that everyone already knew she owned, by themselves they are unremarkable. Far safer to leave them be and let everyone get on with burying the dead.
But then you discovered that the rope had been cut, I said, suggesting murder had been done and leaving the killer open to exposure for the first time, which leads us back to the people in that room at the club.
Except that we were not the only ones who would have known about it,
he countered.
You and I have mentioned it to no one, but Lady C has told Hestia and the board. The Alpenwalders have most likely discussed it amongst themselves.
They have, I said heavily. I had a letter last night from the Baroness. I told him what the note had said, and he gave a nod of satisfaction.
Well, there it is. Nothing more to be done.
Nothing more to be done. You just agreed there is most likely a murderer walking free.
And we can do nothing without the cooperation of the Alpenwalders, except provoke an international incident, which I, for one, do not intend to do. We can do nothing,
he repeated firmly, as he poured a fresh cup of tea for himself. I thought of the last flutter of Hercules' wing as it brushed against my skin. I had given Stoker my word we would not pursue the matter of Alice Baker Green's death, but in the cold light of morning, I regretted it. I regarded him over the breakfast table as he stirred in his sugar and considered my options carefully. We were in the throes of a relationship that was perilously new. Neither of us was accomplished at such things, and I found myself suddenly resisting the compromise and cooperation that were the obvious cornerstones of such endeavours. Was I always to be biting my tongue, squelching my most intrepid impulses in the name of keeping the peace? Was he? It was a chilling thought, and one I rebelled against instantly. I raised my chin and gave him my most defiant look. Can't we?
Veronica,
he said in a dangerously low voice.
You promised.
A promise made under duress is not binding, I said with cool detachment.
Duress? What duress?
He demanded.
I did not exactly hold you at sword point.
No, but our relationship is one of an intimate nature. Such things can be coercive upon the weaker sex, I said demurely.
Weaker?
He choked, and only recovered himself when he had drunk half a cup of tea.
My dear Veronica, any person who would consider you an exemplar of any variety of weakness wants his head examined.
That is very kind of you to say, I am sure, I replied. But the fact remains that I am not entirely comfortable with the promise I made to leave this investigation alone.
There is no investigation,
he reminded me. All the more reason to begin one. Perhaps a quick word with Sir Hugo, I suggested. He pushed aside his teacup with a sigh.
I repeat, what you propose has the potential to create an international incident. The crime, if there was one, occurred in another country, a sovereign country. We have no right, nor does Sir Hugo or any other member of Her Majesty's government, to interfere in their system of justice.
Justice, I rejoined in real bitterness. Where is the justice in refusing to look into the murder at all?
I know this is a matter of frustration for you,
he said gently.
But you agreed enough with my arguments yesterday to give me your word, unless you were crossing your fingers,
he added with a small smile, the smile one might give to a recalcitrant child. Sudden rage boiled up within me, but I smothered it, determined to keep our conversation civil and not, as I was inclined to do, hurl the toast rack at his head. Striving for patience, I attempted a different tack. It is not for my own sake, or even the sake of justice, that I suggest such a thing, I said, adopting a wistful tone. It is only for that poor old granny. He furrowed his brow.
What granny?
Mrs. Baker Green, of course, Alice's grandmother. She has lost so many people dear to her, I said sadly. Her husband, her son, now her granddaughter, all taken from her by the mountains she loves so desperately. I cannot imagine bearing up under that kind of loss.
All the more reason to leave her in peace,
he said sternly. She is very old, you know, nearly 75, and confined to a bath chair, I added. Poor old dear, all those decades of hauling herself up mountains in the coldest and most unforgiving of climates have left her victim to the most devilish rheumatism. I can imagine her now, I went on, painting a picture of maudlin isolation. Sitting by the hearthside, praying just a little of the warmth of the fire will sink into her bones and ease her aching joints, and the long, lonely hours with nothing but the wind for company as it blows in the lonely casement. Stoker looked baffled.
For all you know, she lives in a modern building with steam heat and gas lights.
Of course she doesn't, I retorted. She is a woman of advanced years. Women of advanced years always live in cottages, usually with cats of malodorous appearance.
That is the most absurd statement,
he began. Your old nanny, I hazarded, probably lives in a cottage. It was always a winning strategy to prod his overweening sense of chivalry. He snorted.
My old nanny has a boarding house in Brighton that is fitted with an electric generator because she blackmailed my father into giving her half of my mother's jewels.
I blinked at him. She what? He picked up his teacup again.
That is a tale for another time.
I returned to the subject at hand only with great difficulty, as I made a mental note to revisit the subject of his nanny at a more opportune moment. But surely Mrs. Baker Green would want justice to be done, I pointed out. I know it.
You do not know anything of the sort,
he retorted.
Furthermore,
he did not have the chance to finish that sentence, because just then George the hall boy appeared, trotting quickly with a note that he waved like a crusader's banner. Miss! He exclaimed, thrusting the missive into my hands. It was thick, creamy paper, sealed with blue wax, marked with a complicated cipher, and only slightly begrimed by his grubby hands. I cracked open the seal and noticed at once the elaborate crest at the top.
What new intrigues?
Stoker asked, lazily breaking up the last of the oatcakes to fling to the dogs. I skimmed the few lines. The hand was firm, the language formal. I brandished the page with a smile. It is a summons. From a fellow called von Reckstein, Chancellor of the Alpenwald. He read over the note in obvious astonishment.
You cannot be serious.
I shrugged. It appears we are wanted, and I have kept my promise. I did not pursue this. Stoker swore then, an entirely new phrase I had not heard before. Some new addition to your vocabulary? Or did they teach you that in Naval College? He repeated it as I folded the note. Come along and don't be sulky, I instructed. We are needed.